Hello, and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. You can find me on Welcome to Flatch on Fox. And September 19th, you can catch me in Monster, the Menendez Brothers story on Netflix. I'm in about 5 seconds of it. And our guest today is Bailey Benningfield. She is an LA writer who hosts a monthly table read show called Underscore V1000 at Nico's in Atwater Village. She was kind enough to have my pilot, Smart Cookies, read there. Yeah. She's written for humor websites like Reductress, as well as a bunch of clickbait websites that paid her $50 per article. Boo. These days, she likes to write half-hour comedies and short stories that she shows to one or two people. And in her free time, Bailey mindlessly scrolls Facebook Marketplace and tells her cats she loves them very much. Hi, Bailey.
Hi, Erin. It's good to see you.
You too. I love that you mentioned your cats because the very first cat I had, older than me, was named Bailey, and she was a darling. Oh, she was wonderful.
Wow. It's full circle. There was actually, my next door neighbors as a kid had a golden retriever named Bailey. But yeah, I had the same name as the dog, and that was something that my siblings, you know, liked to make fun at.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
My cat was named after the Irish cream. She was a calico. And
I have some Bailey's, you know, cups and merch. It works
good.
Really well. Yeah.
As you should.
Exactly.
What are you reading these days?
So I recently read Big Swiss.
Oh.
Which was enjoyable. It was fun. I read like Milk Fed by Melissa Broder. And most recently, yesterday, I read Ella Enchanted.
Amazing. I have Big Swiss. I haven't read it. Milk Fed is one of the best books I've read this year. I loved Milk Fed.
I loved Milk Fed too. Such a fun read. And I got to see Melissa Broder read from her upcoming book at a reading like Soho House downtown. That was really fun. And just her voice is very funny.
Yeah, I live sort of near like Pico Robertson and the Chinese restaurant that they go to in Milk Fed. I'm like, I know this. I know that this is a place called Twin Dragon. I know this is real.
Because I've been looking for it. Like I went after I read the book on Google to try to find that exact restaurant. So maybe we have to go sometime.
Yes, I think it's Twin Dragon on Pico.
I completely believe you. I was thinking it was because she mentions like a Hasidic Jewish community, I think.
Yeah.
She's referencing more of like an Orthodox Jewish community, but I was thinking it was maybe like more La Brea, Fairfax area, but that's interesting. So I was looking in the wrong place the whole time.
It's very close. Yeah. You're there. Yeah. Just like the other side of Fairfax. I love that.
And I definitely recommend Big Swiss. It was like a nice quick read and it's also funny.
I'm very excited for Big Swiss. Yeah. And I'm so excited to talk about today's book from 1997 by Gail Carson Levine, Ella Enchanted.
Me too.
I had never read this. The movie was huge. The movie was absolutely foundational to me.
Yes.
And I think I never read the book because the movie was so big. And I couldn't let it not be as good as the book. Right? Yeah. So what's your story with this book? How did it come into your life?
So this book came into my life. My cousin, there's like a big age gap between my mom and my aunt. So all my cousins are a lot older than me. And she gifted it to me for like, I want to say like my birthday in like first grade or something like that. And I have a memory of, you know, Laura gave this to me. She's so cool. Like I got to read this immediately. Like I'm so excited. And then I have a memory of like picking it up and thinking this is slightly above my reading level. Like I can't quite latch onto this right now. I'm still on Magic Treehouse. So I put it away like on my bookshelf for a few years and then the movie came out and I was obsessed with the movie. Like we got it on DVD and I think I watched it like 5 times the first night we got it. Partially because, I mean, I had seen Princess Diaries and that was one of my favorite movies. And I was like, this Anne Hathaway is an up and coming star at 8 years old. I was like, she's got it. And she did. So yeah, I actually really predicted Anne Hathaway's career in the fourth grade. So just want to put that out there, not bragging or anything. But so yeah, I was like addicted to Anne Hathaway. And so I thought, you know, I really have to pick this book back up and read it. And it was, you know, well within my reading level by then. So that was great.
Love that. I also have been, Anne Hathaway's my everything. She has been.
Completely.
She has been since this movie. And I also like Princess Diaries was great. Ella Enchanted was the thing. And Hugh Dancy was also like looking back in time, it was like, oh, this is very like bisexual of you. Like this all makes a lot of sense.
Yes, completely. I remember being like, oh, I should be attracted to this prince. And I guess I mean, I definitely did have a Hugh Dancy moment, but I think I was definitely a lot more fixated on like Anne Hathaway and also that soundtrack. Were you,
Yes.
I was obsessed with the soundtrack, obsessed. Like, I also remember having a friend over, like, she was a childhood friend who lived next door to me, and she was my best friend as a kid, but we kind of grew apart because she grew a little bit cooler, than I did. And
Classic.
so, classic situation repeated several times throughout my life. But I remember she came over because her sister had come over for my sister's slumber party. So, like, she was my little friend during the slumber party. And I made her memorize that, like, the dance number they do,
Yes.
like, let me entertain you, let me make you smile in the like elfin village. And I think she was probably like, what the fuck? And we haven't spoken since. So it is what it is.
But the great thing about that movie is you said dance number, and I was like, wait, which one?
No, truly, truly. And also just the fact that, I mean, when she sings on that table, the giants, it is just.
It's a moment that, like, my father still talks about, that
Well, and she's singing Queen, right? So it's like,
Yes.
yeah, I remember my parents being like, why don't we listen to the real version of this? And I was like, no, let's do the Anne Hathaway version.
Exactly. All respect in the world to Freddie Mercury.
All respect, and I love Queen, but listen.
And so the film turns 20 this year, and they
Right.
did a screening of it in Los Feliz that I got to go to, which was amazing.
Yes.
And the director and one of the writers was there. And so
Cool.
they did a great talk afterwards that was wonderful. And they were very much like, yeah, the book was where we started.
Yeah.
And then we did our own thing.
I mean, I was shocked because I do remember reading this after I saw the movie and being like, so one thing that I really latched on to was the boarding school. Like,
Yeah.
boarding schools were huge for me when I was a kid. I desperately wanted to go to boarding school. And then just rewatching the movie, I was like, oh, this is it. It's just like social justice warrior Ella,
Yeah.
It's not at all like the book, which was so interesting to me, and I had forgotten that they were so different.
They really are, and I think that was something they definitely talked about it at the screening, that Ella became an activist,
Yeah.
really hardcore. And I think that was something that I think is kind of a plus to me in the end between the
Totally.
two.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'll talk a little bit about Gail Carson Levine, the author. Levine, she read avidly when she was a kid. Peter Pan was her favorite. And this is amazing. So she has an incredible career, but in 2005, she gets to write like a Tinkerbell novel for Disney, which I thought was adorable. It was
Oh,
one of her
this.
favorites. She wrote all through grade school, but sort of never thought that like being a writer is a like 20th century career. So she works for New York State for almost 30 years as a welfare administrator, trying to help people get jobs. And so she starts writing kind of seriously at age 40.
Oh, wow.
And her first novel is Ella Enchanted. It comes out a decade after she starts writing. And it is so successful that she's able to quit her day job and write full time.
Wow.
And now she is like running writing workshops for kids and wrote like a nonfiction book for kids about how to write called Writing Magic, Creating Stories
Aww.
That Fly.
Wait, I
Yeah.
want to read that.
Me too. I love it. She seems like just a very nice, sweet person. She loves
Totally.
her husband. Yeah.
Yeah, I was reading the foreword. This isn't my original copy. It's like the 25th anniversary copy or something.
Yeah.
And yeah, she just seems like a really sweet, genuine person who, yeah, loves her partner, which is great. I'm so happy for them.
Yeah, I found this in a little free library.
That was what my cover looked like. Oh.
I was looking at this, and this girl looks like 11 to me. So I was a little confused that
Well,
in the book she's like 15.
yes, I was really confused by that in the book too. But then I was like, oh, I guess maybe it's supposed to take place in olden days where people lived to be like 30 and you had to get married at 15,
Yeah.
But in the movie, she's,
Like 18.
yeah.
Yeah, and this book I think does take course over like a few years, I
Yeah.
think. Like by the end where she's talking about like her correspondence with Char, it was going on for a long time. And I have
That's
to
right.
say, this copy, if you open it, it just says no in
Why?
teeny tiny print.
I love that. Wait,
I don't know.
that is so cute.
But it is like very true to the book and like the moral.
That wasn't something someone added. That was like a...
No, that someone added that. I don't know how.
Wait, I love that. That's awesome.
I'll keep this copy actually and give it to you.
That's oh, so sweet.
The gist of this book is Ella is born and gifted by a fairy with the gift of obedience. She has to do absolutely everything she is told, which of course is bad. And so she is trying to undo it, get it taken off, try to find the fairy Lucinda who gave it to her and break the curse. The amazing thing that I didn't really realize until I was this age watching the movie a couple months ago is, and they say it on the third page in here, she says, I was in danger at every moment about the curse. And there is such danger in this setup, especially for a young woman to do absolutely everything you're told, is terrifying.
It's terrifying. And I think you don't completely get that as a kid, but it is, I mean, there's so many moments where she's in real danger, and like, just I think that Gail Carson Levine does a good job of making the commands just in everyday language that, like, we hear every day, and then noting how that would affect somebody who has this curse and like how dangerous that could really be. There are these magical monsters in this world, but there are also things that, aren't monsters, like her father trying to marry her off to that old guy.
I was really astonished by the father figure. So her mom dies when she's 10-ish in this. And in the movie, her father is very caring and loving. He's just away a lot on business. And in this, he's away a lot on business and also checked out mentally.
And actively malicious.
Yes. Yeah. That was fascinating to me, I think. I think it was like indifference is really kind of an interesting, like neglectful is an interesting layer of, we get evil step parents a lot, and there is one in this book.
There's one who's very evil.
And I think something odd to me is the way this book, I think like the only thing that maybe didn't age well is the way that she talks about her stepsisters and food.
Oh, completely. And the fact that, like, she's like, they're plodding along, my waddling along, my fat little steps, stepsisters.
Yes. Yeah, you have the main stepsister Hattie and then sort of the stupid dumpy one Olive. And that dynamic is kept in the movie. Like there's the ladder climbing one and the stupid one, but the stupidity and food is really intertwined.
It's so intertwined, and also just like that all the villains like smell bad, which, and they all smell like food. I think like the stepmom, she's like, Hattie's feet smell like, did she soak them in stew or something before she, puts her shoes on? It's, yeah, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, but I think overall, I wanted to sort of just start with like the idea of obedience and like how, what was it like in your childhood? Were you unruly? Were you obedient?
I was actually thinking about this during while I was reading the book, and how I think it's such a brilliant like curse to put on a child, because it is like the curse of every child, right? That you are stuck being obedient to these adults, some of whom are, loving and caring and have your best interests in heart. And this is why I kind of love the father figure, or the inclusion of this father figure, which is like, but, some are just these neglectful, selfish idiots who you still have to listen to because you're a kid, and like you are just at the whim of every adult in your life. I think that part didn't exactly resonate with me because I was a pretty obedient kid. I don't think I necessarily saw it as like I'm being obedient. I think I've just, the things that I wanted to do were in line with what my parents wanted me to do. I mean, I need to maybe talk about that in therapy or something, but, and that isn't entirely true, but just from a discipline standpoint, I think I was pretty happy to go to school and read my book in my room, and like I don't know that I fought back against a lot of stuff. I think maybe the thing I really fought back against was that I wanted to watch TV like constantly. I loved TV and reading, like that was, and to this day that's what I love. And they were like, you can't watch so much TV. So that was a big point of kind of disciplinary contention for me and my family. Like, I think my sister, though, was a lot more of like the rebellious sibling while we were super young. And my brother, there's a bit of an age gap, and he was pretty acquiescent as well. So I don't know if that part so much resonated with me, but of course it probably did on some level of just like, yeah, there are commands that I have to follow as a kid.
Yeah, there's definitely a degree of like powerlessness that I think permeates a lot of children's literature. But I think at the same time, like, yeah, I was very obedient. Like you said, not because there was a lot of strife. I think for me, it was like rules are really comforting and helpful. It's like very helpful to be told what to do because I don't know what to do otherwise. And I think Ella sort of throughout the book, it starts as sort of like an inconvenience. And obviously, like part of the book is pushing it to the extremes of like, I think on the back of the book, it's always like she could even chop off her own head if she was told to. It
Yes,
was
exactly.
And I think like Ella is probably would not be unruly or disobedient, but it's the curse that you want to actively push against. It's being forced to do it makes you want to push against it.
And like her little rebellions of like when Mandy's like, come over here, and she takes, really slow steps one at a time. Like, and I do remember, that's something I remember, like trying to find these clever ways around whatever limits your parents were setting up for you, like figuring out the parental codes on the TV so that I could hack into and skip the after school settings that blocked me from watching the TV, like things like that, or just those little moments where you have nothing but your tiny rebellions as a kid. But what's interesting is like what you said about rules being comforting, and like after she sees Lucinda at the wedding and says like, can you please remove this gift, in air quotes for the listeners, like remove this gift so that I don't have to be obedient. She says, you should be happy to be obedient. And like that's when she finally gets some relief, when she is like forced to be happy to be obedient. And that was really interesting to me too. And that is like an element of childhood, right? Like if my parents had just let me watch endless TV.
That moment, which is not in the movie, was really fascinating to me because she doesn't get what she wants. I think that happens, and then there's a while until it sort of comes off, until Mandy says, like, no, you don't have to be happy to be obedient. And this is the sequence in which she agrees to marry some old guy and is very happy about it because she's been told to. And Mandy says, don't be happy about being obedient, Ella. Be whatever you feel about it. And then it says, I was happy to obey. No, I wasn't. The room spun. I began to sob from a relief mixed with sadness. I had been a begging puppy and a delighted slave, yet I hadn't felt cursed since I met Lucinda. Now I did again.
I love that part. Like, I think it's probably the most complicated part of like this children's book, where it's like sometimes you do want to force yourself to be happy with the thing everyone tells you you should, be happy with. And to for someone to say that, no, just feel how you feel about it. I really love that moment.
I think I see phrases like that and I'm like, oh, I don't know how I feel. Like it hasn't, the option to feel it has been like gone for so long that you don't even know how to anymore.
Completely. Yeah.
What was interesting about this is how obviously because it's from first person and it's a novel, we're able to see like the physical effects a lot more of the curse and of not doing it. So when she comes up with these ways to avoid it, they go into the same physical symptoms. And to me, it was like, this is kind of a panic attack.
Exactly, yes.
Thudding heart, tight chest, spinning head. It felt like a migraine. It reminded me a lot of the first time I ever had a panic attack, which was about going to the gynecologist for the first time. And I
I
just
mean,
wasn't.
that's appropriate.
I also watched I watched a lot of TV, and my parents were on board with it until like 11th grade, and it's one of the most humiliating moments of my life. We were in like an after school meeting with my calculus teacher, and I was getting like a C, and my mom's like, well, maybe if you didn't watch so much TV, and pulled out printed receipts of my Netflix log of how much I had watched
That's a teacher. Okay,
in front of
I'm gonna
the teacher.
say that should have been a private conversation
I agree.
and
I
very
agree.
extreme way to approach that, actually.
Wild. But I think it was, I had a lot of fun reading this, like connecting the character of Slannon the elf is so much bigger in the movie. And a real favorite of mine. And I think like the movie talks about like very interesting things about like systemic prejudices and how I think they connect with that character a really interesting through line of like he is also being forced to meet expectations. So even when it's not a curse telling you to do things. There's still these structures of obedience.
It reminded me of, I think I wrote down this line where after the father makes Ella go to boarding school and she doesn't want to, and he says, "You're free to loathe it or to love it, so long as you go." And then Ella says, "It was a taste of obedience without an order, and I didn't like it any better than the Lucinda-induced kind." I love
I
that.
highlighted that too.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. You're free to
Yeah.
loathe it or love it so long as you go.
Yeah. And just that kind of her pushing back against obedience, even outside her curse. And also when it becomes somebody who is malicious toward her, because that's the first time I think a character is kind of malicious toward her, because we only have the mother and Mandy in the beginning of the story, and that she like senses that malice and resents the obedience that she has to have there, which, yeah, I guess is kind of like slanted.
Yeah, I mean, there's this
Yeah.
steady escalation of like how it works in her house. We
Yeah.
bring in like Hattie and Olive in the boarding school.
Yeah.
There's the moment where Hattie demands, it's like a really big turning point in both
Yeah.
the movie and the book when Hattie tells her to give her dead mother's locket.
Yes.
Is like still hurts. It's still
Yeah.
like all
Yeah.
these years later, is still real rough.
Yeah.
And then it's like the ogres and there's like a threat to life. And I think something that the movie in this thing did better is that this, like, in the book, she's falling in love with Char, who's the prince of the kingdom. I love that the kingdom's name is Frel, Ella of
It's
Frel.
so cute.
But it's that I can't be with Char because someone could order me to like do something wrong and or hurt him. And in the movie, she's commanded to kill him. And that scene, I've been writing a horror movie for a year or two, and I had a huge epiphany where I was like, it's the end of Ella Enchanted. It's the scene where she's holding the dagger and she goes, "You
Yeah.
will no longer be obedient." And I really ultimately liked that breaking of the curse a lot more.
I think definitely for a movie, it was so much more active, right?
Yeah.
Not to be like make active choices, you know? But I guess the thing about the book, because it's all kind of theoretical, she's sort of like, okay, well, I could be told to do these things.
Right.
And so I'm not going to marry Char, and in not marrying him, I'm protecting the kingdom, and that's what finally breaks the curse. Whereas, like in the movie, yeah, she's actually asked to do it. I agree. I like that better too. I think it's a stronger ending. Sorry, Gail.
Yeah. In this, I was an hour or two ago, I was going through my notes for this. And in this, I was like, I don't actually know where the curse gets broken. And so I went through, and it's really like, I think it's like the second to last chapter, but it's sort of like she just is, I think, like, again, from an outside perspective, as like a viewer, she's just like rocking on the floor for an
Yeah.
hour or two.
Yes. I was actually thinking as I was reading that, I'm so glad I don't have to see that portrayed in a movie, because I think that would be such a hard thing to do as an actor, to like
Yeah.
sell that internal world as people are standing around you, kind of looking at you, going, "What the fuck?"
Exactly. She goes, concentrated in a point deep in my chest, there was room for only one truth. I must save Char. And for a moment, I rested. And in that moment, I found a power beyond any I'd had before, a will and determination I would never have needed if not for Lucinda, a fortitude I hadn't been able to find for a lesser cause. I found my voice.
Yeah.
I think the big thing, especially in our like generation and age bracket, is it was very much like, you know, her whole story is for a boy, or like she, you know,
Yes.
every story about a young girl had to be critiqued through like whether or not there was a love interest. I remember Frozen coming out and everyone being like, "She doesn't have a love interest. Whoa!"
Yeah.
We're cured. And so
Right.
I think it was like, it's great that she says, "I found my voice," but in this, it does feel like, well, I love Char enough. 2 pages later, Char was enough to have been
Yes.
like, Kyria, that is the kingdom. I guess her town is Frel. Kyria was enough. Char was enough. And it's sort of like, well, that sucks.
I completely agree. Completely agree. Because I mean, I was like, okay, the idea that, you know, you love someone so much that you are finally able to like step into yourself fully to show up for them is amazing. But that love can come in so many forms of like friendship, your family, and even, I mean, I kind of hated that that she was gonna, you know, die when the ogres capture her, and that wasn't enough, right, to break
Yeah.
the curse. And I'm like, well, what are you saying when you're saying, okay, well, Char was finally enough to do it, but like I couldn't do it for myself. And I mean, I don't know, maybe there's something there, but I was kind of like, it would have been, I think, more powerful if, you know, she still falls in love with Char. That's great, but maybe even the curse is broken for like Arita, who's her best friend in the book. Or, you know, maybe she can't do it when she's with the ogres, but maybe there's another moment where she has to save her own life, where she's finally able to, and like she's the one who's enough finally. You know, something like that. That's corny, but I feel like that is probably how it would have been written like today.
Yeah. Without fail, I end up talking about Wizard of Oz on this podcast every episode because it's a foundational text for me.
It's huge.
But I think like the thing with that and the thing in the movie, and I think like the movie and the book, those scenes are like have a lot of similarities to them in their essence. And it's like the execution of some things that change it. And in Wizard of Oz, it's the line of like you had the power all along.
Right, exactly.
And that comes out way clearer in the movie. I think the realization is so well articulated in the movie of like everyone else has the power to give me commands. I also have the power to command and expect and want. And so I think it's like Char is the situation in the movie, and it's like everything is taken away from me, and I deserve to have a partner, you know?
And it's, and to be like, okay, well, I deserve to have romantic love, but it doesn't get extended to like familial love, you know, friendship love, self-love. It's all kind of based around romantic love, which I didn't love.
And I think the character of Arita, her friend, is pretty much the same, I think, in terms of like size. I think so often about the scene in the film where they have their friend break up.
I was like out loud to my TV, like, no.
Yeah. That like Anne Hathaway, I've always loved for so many reasons. She's also an incredible actress, just bar none, from a young age. And that scene is like a masterclass in acting, to the point where like I was doing a self-tape a couple months ago, and I was like, it's that scene. Like, study that, do
Like, I
that.
have to channel the friendship breakup right now. Enchanted.
Because her, I think it's her stepmom tells her like you can't be friends with this girl anymore, but you can't tell. That's a huge part of both the book and the movie of like you can't talk about the curse. You're not allowed to. That's a thing from her mother. So she's like crying and trying to like the scene I was doing, it's like this character's friend had like just gone through an ordeal and needed to be comforted, but there's like a monster in the house or something. So I'm trying to tell her to go away, you know?
Totally. So you're like, just go.
Yeah, exactly. It's like I'm really sorry that happened to you, but and it's like how it's trying to calculate like what is the worst thing I can say to you to get you to leave but not ruin everything. Yeah, it's
That it's like
really
so far beyond repair that if, you know, this curse does get broken, how can I come back to you? I like in the book that she just runs away.
Yeah, she does. She just runs away from boarding school.
She's like, all right. Not for
Yeah.
me. Not gonna do the friendship breakup scene. I was so relieved because I was really dreading it in the book.
Yeah.
I love their friendship so much, and that was, I think that was a big something I just remember from reading it in childhood of like how much I loved their friendship at the boarding school, and yeah, it was so sweet. Kind of wanted that to be the thing that helps her break the curse, you know?
Yeah, I think that's something that both the movie and the book, like if we were again to do it again, and I don't think we need to, but I think that is a big thing to bring her in a lot more, Arita. And I know that Gail Carson Levine did another, like wrote another book set in Aortha. I think it was,
It's
maybe
called like
it's,
Ogre Enchanted, I think.
oh
It's
God.
is it I think so it's in the back of my
Oh, so there might be like a prequel to this that's about the
Yes.
ogres
Yeah,
and like the political backstory.
I have two chapters in the back of my book, so maybe I'll
Ooh.
look into it. Yeah, where the story began.
I like that there's like both in this and in the movie, there's a degree of like political intrigue of like what's happening in all the different countries.
Totally, yeah. She, you know, ends up being like this perfect little diplomat, you know, queen, because she's so into languages and learns all these languages like very kind of absurdly quickly.
Yeah, I thought that was really nice. I think in the end she like becomes court linguist, which is cute.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
Yeah, because I think like something great about the movie is that she has this activist streak in her, which makes complete sense. And I think like the closest kind of depth we get to that in the book is the languages thing, which feels, it doesn't necessarily feel like it comes from like an emotional place in the way that the activism does, I think, to me.
Completely. Yeah. I like that adaptation for the film, I think, of just making her concerned about the kingdom in that way rather than like just watching her learn languages on screen. Although I'm like, maybe that would be fun too. I feel like a lot of books with languages have people who work on actually creating a real language for the book. Like I watched a documentary about this. It's just random consonants capitalized.
Nice.
It's,
Yes.
I'm pretty sure. Like, I don't think you could learn to speak Ogurese or whatever.
Yeah, I was trying to be like, maybe it's backwards. Maybe
Yeah.
it's like, do I hold it up to a mirror? It didn't work.
Whatever
But,
it is, I was like, she just slammed the
yeah.
keyboard and whatever happened, happened.
And I respect
I
that.
respected that too. I was like, I'm not trying to figure this out.
Something I'm glad there was not ultimately in the movie is that Char gives Ella a pet centaur.
Oh my God, that was crazy. Crazy. I was like, so you have a half man walking around your house. And I
Yeah.
think the way she gets away with making that ethical, not really, is
Yeah.
by like making the centaurs have no language, right? Or like
Yeah.
they're just basically have the mind of like a bird, right?
Yes.
So it's not like you're keeping a human as a pet, but you still kind of are.
Exactly. The reasoning is like, don't worry, they're too stupid.
Yeah,
Like,
exactly.
yeah. And so there's only a few moments with the centaur, but yeah, she does like go to have a pensive moment
Yeah.
with it. And it's just like dopey and kind of
Yeah.
like zoned out.
She's like, this is the creature I can tell all my secrets to because it's so stupid.
Yeah,
And you're like,
that could have been Arita. Yeah, that could
yeah.
have been a
Yeah.
friend.
And I guess because so I read part of the book and then watched the movie that night and then went back to the book and I was kind of expecting her to realize the centaur had sentience and could understand what she was saying and it would be like a moment of her fighting for the centaur's rights. But yeah, you really don't get that activism element really at all. And
Yeah. But overall, like, I'm glad I read it. And I think, like, yeah, I think the movie's better. And maybe that's because I'm a screenwriter, you know? And like, it has the structure a lot better. So much of this book takes place in letters, which, again, like, yeah, that works in a novel. Doesn't
yeah.
really work. And the whole time I was like, God, Hugh Dancy was so perfect. Like,
Was.
every line that he said, I was like, oh no, I can hear it exactly. There's a moment in the climax where Hattie says, Ella, go to your room. His Majesty can have no further need of you. And Char says, I have great need of her.
Yeah, it's so sort of golden retriever boyfriend, like slightly doltish. Yeah, the casting for Ella Enchanted, the movie, was so perfect. Hattie is amazing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that actress, it was going around on Twitter or TikTok or something. That actress specifically has played like evil stepsister number one,
Yeah.
maybe five times in
Yeah.
different
She's
Cinderella
so good at it.
adaptations. It,
Right. Which I also forgot that this is just a Cinderella adaptation. Like
yeah.
the glass slipper moments and the carriage turning into the, back into a pumpkin at midnight. But I kind of didn't like that.
Yeah, I think in the little bit of research I did, it was like Gail Carson Levine had Cinderella and was like, this doesn't make sense. Why does Cinderella do everything she's
Yeah.
told?
Yeah.
Why doesn't
Right.
she just like run away or something?
Hey.
But yeah, the elements of like the pumpkin feels very shoehorned in. I think
Yeah.
like again, I think like the screenplay mostly just like tightened things, you
Yeah.
know? So like in the book, there are three consecutive balls at the end, and the glass slipper, is that his mom's?
I want to say it's his mom's. I think you're right. But I was trying to find her reasoning for why she made a Cinderella adaptation. And I was like, okay, well, Cinderella does just do everything, and is sort of very acquiescent and like sad all the time.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, that does make sense. So like when they turn her into a maid at the end, call her Cinders, I was like, this is a little on the nose.
Yeah. I think especially at that point, you're like 80% of the way through the book.
Right,
And
right.
you're like, we're just getting all of this stuff now. And they have the glass slipper in the movie, but it is just like Vivica A. Fox plays Lucinda and is just like, here's your new outfit. And it
Oh,
happens to include.
yes. And I did. One thing I don't like about the movie is there are too many coincidences. And this is something I hate in screenwriting is when people use coincidences, like pretty much ever, but especially to like excessively. I think there are several coincidences. And so in the book, I was like, oh, well, there aren't, because I told you I read like half of it, finished it after I watched the movie. And I was like, well, in the book, there aren't as many just coincidences, but she actually does lean on that really heavily toward the end. And just also the logic of, like, oh, my father's going to this wedding, and then making all these leaps of like, oh, but Mandy said that fairies love to be at weddings, and so I'm just going to go to this random wedding, 5,000 miles away and see if Lucinda's there. Didn't love that. But at least in the book, Ella calls upon Lucinda to grant these wishes at the ball. I don't know. I wish that's the thing I wish were different about the movie is that there weren't so many coincidences.
And I think that's something that often happens with children's media of like they're not going to pick up on it, and if we just put a song and dance number there.
Yes, completely, completely. And I was like, I didn't pick up on that when I was a
Yeah.
kid, so I guess it worked.
Although it does make me think that again, something I do love about the movie that it made me realize is that, because I was thinking they have a shot where everyone, it's like it's in like Scooby-Doo, but like everyone's like peering around a door and their heads are all stacked up around the door, and it's like Slannon and then Ella and the ogre. And I was like, they bring different warring factions, different ethnicities together to come save the kingdom. Heidi Klum is there as a giant.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that is a clue. I was like, who is this? I couldn't pinpoint.
At the screening, all the director and writer could talk about is how bad the effects were. And I was like, they're not horrible.
For 2004, they're great. For now,
Yeah.
yes, they are horrible. I mean, it was really, I was, there was a moment where, oh, it's at the giant's wedding. They just
Yeah.
like film the giant's wedding as the normal people and then like shrink them down on a green screen. And it's
Yeah.
really bad, but
Yes.
that's okay.
They definitely did their best. They really, truly burst into song at the end.
Oh my God. Don't Go Breaking My Heart was huge. And I thought, so the Jesse McCartney, version on the soundtrack, it's just beautiful. It was
I'm going
great.
back to my parents' house in a couple of days. I need to find that CD. I'm pretty sure I still have it.
Yeah, you totally have to. I wonder if it's on Spotify.
I don't think the whole thing is. I think I looked because there's a version of Strange Magic that they made for the movie.
Yes.
The other day, my boyfriend and I were listening to the radio, and like the original Strange Magic came on. And I was like, "Do you know this song? Have you?" And he goes, "No, what are you talking about?" Because he did
You're
not.
like, he didn't watch Ella
No,
Enchanted.
he didn't.
I once heard the original song and I was shocked. I
Yeah.
thought this certainly was for Ella Enchanted, an exclusive content made just for this fantastic film. And turns out it's not.
Man, and Jesse McCartney.
I mean, he was huge.
He has a song in, I think, the fourth Halloween Town called Right Where You Want Me. That's feels
That's a
so
deep cut.
explicit,
That's
but
a
a
deep cut.
fantastic song.
Absolutely. I mean, he really, I hope he's doing well.
Yeah, love him.
I love him too. Beautiful soul.
The kids 2 years younger than us had One Direction, and we had Jesse McCartney.
Exactly. We had Jesse McCartney and like Aaron Carter. I know you kind of mentioned that it reminds you of panic attacks, right? That
Yeah.
she has kind of panic attacks when she can't, which is trying to resist obeying. And I also highlighted like when she's at the boarding school and she's just getting so many commands and she's like reciting them to herself constantly. So in my mind, I repeated my commands in an endless refrain. That I was like, a little OCD-esque,
Yeah.
of her as well. And then also just touching on her grieving too for her
Yeah.
mother a lot of the time. Like I think something that Char gives her is this permission to just like grieve and to bring her up and mention her mother, which I thought was really sweet.
Yeah, I liked how they built out the beginning of her relationship with Char, that he, because they literally run into each other in the movie. She's running because she was ordered to shoplift, and he's running from a horde of fans, which is like I liked the screaming horde of fans. It felt
I did
very of the
too.
aughts,
Yes,
like.
complete like the fan club nature of, oh my God, yeah. And I also wrote down something I thought was so brilliant from his introduction is like the first thing, like Ella refuses to curtsy and she says something like, she says something like, you can't make me curtsy. And he goes, that's your choice. There's really nothing I can do about it. And like that was such a great introduction
Yeah.
of his character, in relation to her curse.
Yeah. He meets her, or like he knows her. He says, "I really respected your mom and I really loved her and I have fond memories of her." He's at her funeral. I think, in terms of just like good fictional boyfriends, he's really tuned in and he's
He
really
is.
sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's a really
Yeah.
good guy.
He's a good guy. He really is. I mean, he's a sweet boyfriend. and husband and king. And I think there are elements of that in the book too that I don't think I didn't highlight, but where he's just always like, well, I couldn't make you do anything. Like, I could never force anyone to do anything. This is probably a pretty surface level observation, but obviously has some implications for consent,
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
particularly with, when she's going to be married off to that old guy. And I think that I honestly wonder if she wrote that the old man as like evil at first and then was like, oh, this is too dark for a children's book, because that felt like it would, bring up a lot of issues of consent that I'm sure she really want to deal with.
Yeah, I think that was the big thing seeing the movie, even reading it now. Just the main thing as an adult is like the incredible. Like you can't hear this concept without thinking about rape. Like you,
Completely.
especially because it's a young girl and just the sense of it entirely. And I feel like there's no way that she could make it about that. And like my cover says that it's for ages 8 and up. So like definitely couldn't. There's even I think there was an interesting addition in here where there's like special acquiescence mushrooms
Yes, I would.
that her dad tells Mandy the cook slash fairy godmother to put in their food.
I know. And so there are these moments that kind of, I guess what's so great about it taking place in this fantastical world is that you can bring up those consent issues, but through like the ogres telling her to cook, if the ogres told me to cook myself, I would have to. But yeah, like I think that kind of drugging them is pretty damn close to, bridging that consent issue. And then her being so thrilled to then be with this old man because she's drugged and then is happy to be obedient was, I don't know, really interesting. And I feel like if she had made him evil, that would have, it just would have been too dark for.
Yeah, I think like a big part of that sequence is that Lucinda has told her, like you said, to be happy being obedient. I think that really colors it. But I think also interesting in that sequence is that Alec really reckons with like cognitive dissonance of like my body is doing something and my emotions are doing something when I don't want it to. I think that is throughout the book.
And I guess what's interesting about that scene is that she doubles up on like, the drug of the happiness of obedience, because Lucinda's told her she needs to be happy to be obedient, and then the drug of the mushrooms. And I kind of wonder what the purpose of doubling up on those two things is, kind of like structurally and just for her as a character, because it seems like she would be happy in that scene, either way. So I don't know. I wonder if it like the mushrooms are because she wanted to bring up issues of consent, like in a romantic setting. I don't know.
It does feel like you said doubled up.
So I don't know. I wonder why she did that, or I don't really have any
I don't
idea
either.
about it. I just,
Yeah. I think it's interesting. Because I don't think this is in the movie that when her father and Dame Olga get married, Lucinda gift slash curses them to what always be together. They can never leave each
Always.
other's presence.
That's the giants that
Oh yes,
curse to
yes.
always be. That was confusing to me because it was like they have to always, they'll always be in love with each other no matter.
Right.
And so again, it is this idea of like being forced to feel something or that you really don't feel, like it's a marriage of convenience, really. But they kind of get around it by just never being with each other and always like longing for each other. And that doesn't seem to be a real issue. So she kind of skirts around it in that way.
Yeah, you're exactly right. They'll always be in love, and then they discover, like they get married and immediately discover neither of them has the money that each other married them for. There was something really interesting, I think, just about like in terms of like fantasy parents, the mom is always dead, and they do lean into that. Although, like a lot of kids lose a parent, and they do, like you said, to have a really interesting discussion about grief. But I think it was just also really interesting to have a parent who's just like, I technically have a dad, but that's it.
But he just gave birth to me, and now I'm in his care because of outside circumstances, you know?
Where it's sort of like genetic material and co-proximity.
I thought that was really interesting too. I liked that element of it and just how explicit she is about like, I don't want to be around this man.
Yeah.
There's no like, oh, but he's my father. It does. I did like toward the end when she starts writing to him and is like, maybe he'll care that I'm a, a servant.
Yeah.
And then he, of course, doesn't. There are moments where she's like, well, he's better than, Dame Olga, but we never really see that.
Yeah, Dame Olga, I think, is sort of more action happens through Hattie than through Dame Olga. But that was a really interesting moment you brought up where she's like being treated as literal Cinderella is happening. And she writes to her father and she's like, his pride and ego will be hurt if I'm being a servant, which I thought was like so. I think that's an incredible degree of like emotional intelligence just to give to a kid. And I think also like that Levine, the author, is being like, yeah, sometimes you're like, you don't have to like your parent and it's okay.
And that sometimes like your the way that you move through the world or are viewed is more a reflection of their ego than it is like you as a person. I really
Absolutely.
love that moment too.
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah.
In my adolescent literature class I took with college, there's a lot of my professor brought up how many protagonists of adolescent novels or like youth, young adult novels are into reading. And it's like to create this automatic identification with, the
Yeah.
adult reader themselves who's reading it. So I thought that was interesting that like the writing mistress is the only good mistress because Ella becomes so, loves reading and loves writing. So that was
Yeah.
interesting. It's just funny that she's leaning into that trope a little bit.
But you're so right. That is every, yeah. I don't think I had ever thought of it that way, but you're absolutely right.
Because you're
Yeah.
just immediately like, oh, this is me. I'm
Same.
currently reading, Person
Exactly.
loves to read. It's like
And
this
yet,
very.
like, I just did Inkheart on this podcast, and it was so annoying in that one. I think because they do overdo it, where like your whole personality is books.
I couldn't get into Inkheart because I think I'm very into like fantasies where there's like interpersonal drama, but some fantasies where they're like dragons and war and like maybe it's slightly more masculine elements. And obviously there's interpersonal drama there too, but I think I kind of shut down when I see like a mouse at war or something, which Inkheart's about a dragon, right?
No, so that's actually we
Oh.
both my guest and I thought it was, and there are no
Oh.
dragons in it.
Why was it like, was there a dragon on the cover? Is that why I think?
There's like a little lizard, so like something reptilian. No, Inkheart's like if I read something from the book, it comes out of the book and comes to life.
Oh, I
Yeah.
see. Okay. Maybe I'll give it a shot.
It's not required.
Okay.
Would you consider this required reading?
No.
I agree.
Just
Yeah.
because, I mean, I think it's a fun book. Like, it's really fun and it's brings up a lot of, identification that you have as a child with certain elements, but I wouldn't call it required.
I agree. The book is not required reading for me. Sorry,
No.
Gail. And then I was like, well, is the movie required viewing for me? And I think like, maybe not. I think like I always want to have a DVD on me. Like I am always gonna like
Amen.
anytime I had a like a road trip until maybe 12th grade, I had the
Oh, the
DVD
little
on me.
portable DVD player. Oh my God, addicted completely.
Yes, always, always, always. But then I like asked my boyfriend to come and the like he couldn't get out of work in time or something. And I came back and I was like, it was so great. I had so much fun. And also, you will still completely understand me, even if you don't watch this 90-minute
Yes,
movie.
exactly. It wasn't like, I mean, rewatching it, there was a nostalgia factor and just the joy of watching something that you watch so repeatedly as a kid and knowing like something in you knowing what's about to happen next, even if you can't do the exact line. Like that to me is so fun because I haven't seen this movie for, 15 years. So that was really fun, but I wasn't like, oh, there was something that fundamentally changed me here, or really
Yeah.
formed the way I moved through the world.
Yeah, it's like I'm so glad I had it.
So glad.
Not everybody needs to. Like,
So,
yeah, and that's okay.
that's okay. But hopefully people who love this book and movie will enjoy this episode.
Yeah. Do you have anything to plug as we round out?
Not particularly. I mean, we're gonna have another show. It's a monthly pilot reading show at Nico's, but I don't know the date yet. I usually post it on my Instagram, so you can follow me there. I'm private on it, but only because I work with high school students, and I've posted, you know, photos in my, you know, I get up to debauchery, nothing crazy, but I don't want
17 children.
Yeah. So you can follow me on there.
Yeah.
And I'll post. And it's my at is Bailey Benningfield.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Erin. This was really fun. I'm so glad we did this.
Me too.
Thank you so much to Bailey. I really liked this one. I think it's a good episode. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. And I'm recording this on a Tuesday and it doesn't come out until Thursday. But on September 19th, on Netflix, you can catch me in a few seconds of Monster, the Menendez brothers story. I think I'm in episode 6 in a little flashback sequence, unless they cut me, and that would be embarrassing, but that's showbiz, baby. You can support the podcast at buymeacoffee.com/requiredreading. I might have already said that, so thank you for, just thank you for being here. I had vacation. It was wonderful. I hope you get a little bit of peace and quiet. And I hope this was restful and restorative for me. Again, I know I said this, but it's how we end the show. You can find me everywhere at Erin R. Bowles. The R stands for what? Restful and restorative. And a little raspy. My voice is a little hecked up because of cat hair and dust. How embarrassing, but also very in character. All right, thank you!